Hello and welcome to the Scholar's Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, does power breed hypocrisy? And if so, why? And what might be the social and political implications? Then, media and social change, we'll look back at one short-lived magazine that shook America. Finally, as we anticipate a Supreme Court decision on President Obama's signature health care law, we'll dissect the problems and potential solutions for the United States health care system. After a decade of ethics scandals, psychologists began to wonder, does power breed hypocrisy? That became the subject of a psychological study that looked at why powerful people, those who often speak in highly moral language, don't always do as they say. The study found that, in fact, there is a correlation between power and hypocrisy, whereby the powerful people hold others to high moral standards, but they tend to go easy on themselves. We have one of the authors of this study, Adam Galinsky, with us. Adam Galinsky is a professor of ethics and decision making in management at the School of Management at Northwestern University. Welcome, Adam Galinsky.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's great to have you with us. You found that power and influence themselves can cause what you called a severe disconnect between public judgment and private behavior.
Absolutely. That's what we found. Well, we found two sort of main effects in our studies, which I think are important. The first is that power leads people to act in an immoral or unethical way. And so what we found in our studies is that those people who were randomly assigned to experimental conditions in which they had power in our experiments were more likely to cheat in games, were more likely to say that it was okay to fudge expenses, a number of different things. And so one of the key things that this research shows is that although there are more eyes on the powerful, ironically, the powerful feel psychologically invisible, and that then licenses them to act in all of these immoral ways. You could think of power as very much like the Ring of Gyges of Plato, which is popularized in The Lord of the Rings, like exactly what Gollum and Frodo were after, was this cloak of invisibility that then unleashed all of this selfish, self-interested, you know, behavior. But that doesn't make them hypocrites. That just makes them immoral. What makes the powerful hypocrites is they simultaneously hold others to higher standards than they hold for themselves.
Now, I wonder if this would have some explanation to the historic Stanford prison experiment where they randomly assigned students to be prison guards or prisoners, and the prison guards really got abusive.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a contemporary explanation of that. These Stanford undergraduates were randomly assigned to the role of either prisoners or guards. The guards abused their power, tended to almost torture the people, act in ways that satisfied whatever their self-interest were, and then held these people to a very narrow band of acceptable behavior of the prisoners.
You found also that this phenomenon depends somewhat on a sense of legitimacy or a legitimacy. What did you mean by that?
We know why the powerful act immorally, right, is because they feel psychologically invisible. It's like this, you know, cloak of invisibility that licenses them to act in a way that satisfies their self-interest. The reason why the powerful hold higher standards for others, I think, is two mechanisms. The first is it's a way to control other people's behavior, right? If the powerful can hold other people to high standards and punish them when they deviate from them, that's one mechanism they can hold onto their power. Mm. The second thing is that they feel, in some sense, as in their position of authority, that that's what they're supposed to do. That's what they're legitimated to do, right, is to hold standards and structures of authority for other people. And so we found in our studies that when people are in positions of power, but they were concerned about the legitimacy of their position or whether they truly deserved it, then we saw some of this hypocrisy start to disappear. And in fact, we saw, in some ways, ironically, the reverse, where the powerful became harder on themselves than they were on others in states of illegitimacy.
You talked a little bit in your study about a sense of entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if, in fact, the sense of entitlement came first or if it came later.
Meaning, so whether people have a sense of entitlement and act immorally achieve positions of power, or whether power causes them to have a sense of entitlement and act immorally?
That, as well as the sense of power leading to the sense of entitlement leading to the immoral behavior. What comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated thing. I think that for the first question, we know that at least power has some causal force in this because we took people in the lab, randomly assigned them to either a powerful or powerless role, and saw dramatic changes in the standards they imposed on others and their own behavior. I think that probably there's a sense that when you put people in the position of power, they do feel entitled, and that entitlement allows them to both act in a way that satisfies their own self-interest, even when it's immoral, such as cheating, and license them to impose strict standards on others.
Now, you mentioned this psychological invisibility, which maybe it's not invisibility so much as accountability, is my guess.
Absolutely.
A little less invisible, a little more accountable. What explains this hypocrisy element?
I think part of the hypocrisy element is just two different forces going in opposite directions. And humans are rationalization, justification machines. We are very good at rationalizing things. And people in power, I think, don't notice that there is this disconnect between the standards they impose on others and their own behavior. I'm sure they have lots of justification reasons why it made sense for me to cheat in this case for these reasons, but that doesn't mean that I'm really acting in a violation of these standards. And I think something else you said before, which is very, very important, which is the word accountability. And that comes the solution to this problem. I think the reason why the powerful act in such hypocritical ways is especially when they're not being held accountable for their behavior. And research on corporate governing boards, boards of directors show that they fail very often in fulfilling their fiduciary duty, which is to serve a control mechanism for CEOs. We see this throughout the world with governments when there's a check on the balance, either through the judiciary or legislator on presidential or prime minister activities, then we see less abusive behavior. So one of the key solutions of our research, I think, is to say finding ways to make those people, CEOs, presidents, prime ministers, whoever it is, to feel accountable and therefore have to explain and justify their behavior, I think would lessen this problem.
I was actually going to ask you about political and social implications of this. But as I was thinking about this, we as a society grant power to people all the time. We grant power to our representatives, our presidents. And it is really difficult to have these limitations placed on these because of the amount of power that they have.
Well, I think, power is a central animating force in social life. There's no question about it. And some other research that my colleagues and I have done have said basically hierarchy, right, where some people have more power and some people have less power, is the most common form of social organization in the world, right? And in fact, not just among humans, but among species. And the reason why is that hierarchy solves lots of problems. It solves coordination problems. It solves conflict problems. It gives people incentives to work hard and to motivate performance. And so once we give people power, oftentimes it seems very well deserved because of all of those processes. But you can still have people in positions of power and still hold them accountable. And I think that one of the metaphors I like to use is, how do you turn power into leadership? Well, think about driving a car. Well, what do you need to do to drive a car? Well, you have to press on the gas. You need acceleration to go somewhere. But you also need a steering wheel so you don't crash into things. So what power does, it kind of gives you that pedal, that acceleration, but we need accountability to give people better steering.
Finally, I wanted to talk about the people who didn't have power. And they were much harder on themselves,
yes.
And they were more lenient on others' moral transgressions. Talk about that.
Well, I think a colleague of mine at NYU, John Jost, has written a lot about going back to sort of Marxist theories of false consciousness and talking about this idea of justifying the systems that we're in, even when those systems discriminate against us. And I think, he's shown in a lot of his research that there's a number of psychological processes that low-power people do that conspire to keep them in low power. And I think this is just one of those processes in which the powerless being harder on their own behavior and being more lenient towards others sort of keeps them in a place of subjugation and sort of helps reinforce the social hierarchy.
And so you've got to start to think about how do you resolve that issue as well.
Right. And I think, one of the ways to do that is to also, you want to make people feel empowered who are below, and you want to make people above feel accountable.
It seems like it's this catch-22 as well, where the more power you get, the more you're willing to voice your opinions and less sensitivity you have to social disapproval gives you more power.
Absolutely. And I think that, one of the irony things of power is that to get power, you have to be a pretty good perspective taker. You have to understand the desires of those with more power. But once you get power, you tend to lose that capacity.
Well, thank you so much, Adam Galinsky, for joining us. When we come back, what are the impacts of mass media on politics? We'll take a look at one short-lived publication and how it changed America, if even for a little while. Stay tuned.
Through his killing field, in the name of his God, but thou shalt not kill. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won now.
You are listening to the Scholar's Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. What is the impact of media? What is the media's role in political and social change? One short-lived U.S. publication called Ramparts changed a number of aspects of American politics and American journalism, at least for a while. In its short life, the publication exposed CIA torture, published photographs of napalmed Vietnamese children, and the diaries of Che Guevara. It served as a launching pad for numerous intellectuals, political leaders, and journalists, including Noam Chomsky, Bobby Seale, Seymour Hersh, William Grider, Jonathan Kozol, Christopher Hitchens, Angela Davis, even Brit Hume, who now serves as a Fox News anchor. The publication also put out the early works of writers such as Kurt Vonnegut, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and Nobel Literature Prize winner Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It spawned new publications, including Rolling Stone and Mother Jones. We're joined by Peter Richardson, who is the author of a book about Ramparts called A Bomb in Every Issue. And we also have with us Robert Scheer, who is one of the editors of the publication. And he is now the author of numerous books, co-host of Left, Right, and Center, and the founder of the internet publication Truth Dig. So welcome, Peter Richardson.
Thank you, Maria.
And welcome, Robert Scheer.
I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you back on the air with us. So I guess we should start with Peter Richardson to talk about the founding of Ramparts and the politics that it was born into, how it played into it, how it gave birth to it. This was the years of Kennedy, Pat Brown, Bay Area politics, anti-communism, and the Cuban Revolution. Tell us about that.
Well, right. I mean, Ramparts magazine actually started as a Catholic literary quarterly. It didn't have a strongly progressive political slant. The original vision was that it would put out things that were sympathetic to and supportive of sort of liberal Catholicism. But that changed very quickly when the original publisher, Edward Keating, hired Warren Hinkle as his executive editor. And it was Warren who began sort of juicing up the magazine, giving it a little bit more sensational content. But one of his chief accomplishments was recruiting Robert Scheer as the foreign correspondent focusing on Asia, Southeast Asia, and especially Vietnam. And then later, Bob became the managing editor. And that changed the political direction of the magazine considerably.
Well, before we bring Robert Scheer on to talk about this, you wrote in the book a little bit about his own background and what the changes were that you saw at Ramparts. Talk about that, and let's then bring Bob in.
It was an important dimension to the success of the magazine. They had already sort of come up with a pretty good-looking magazine under the art direction of Dugald Sturmer. They had the showmanship from Warren Hinkle. They had the financial backing of Ed Keating. But what Bob added was a lot more political savvy and a lot of that more deeper ideological commitments, and a lot of that did reflect his background. He grew up in New York, and he went to City College. He came out to Berkeley. He was intensely interested in Asia, first China and then Vietnam. So he knew, and he went to Vietnam, and that distinguished him from a lot of people who were writing about it at that time. And he came back and told people, listen, everything you've been hearing about Vietnam is very badly garbled or just wrong. And that was a huge contribution to make at that time in the magazine's development, but also to the country's political discourse.
All right, Bob Scheer, let's bring you in. Talk a little bit about...
Yeah, every time I hear Peter talk about his book, he makes it much more boring. The book is great, and I'm so happy it's out in paperback, and I just bought 3 copies. And what Peter managed to do, I mean, he's not a great radio interviewer as far as I'm concerned, but he's a terrific writer. And the book is a joy to read. And what he did is he captured the wild, crazy, free spirit of Ramparts. It was not ideological. I was a part of it. I was not, you know, the whole deal by any means, and not, maybe sometimes not even that important. Because first of all, let me just correct him on one thing. Even though it started as a Catholic literary quarterly, its early importance was that it strongly backed the farm workers and Cesar Chavez, who was himself a Catholic, and took a very strong position on civil rights. And you have two streets in Los Angeles. You have Cesar Chavez Street down there, and you have Martin Luther King, as do most cities. And let me tell you, when we published those people and we celebrated them and gave openness to them, which began actually before I was even involved, it was in the spirit of Pope John. It was in the spirit of a whole new Catholic awakening of social conscience. And we published Martin Luther King later on the war when the New York Times condemned him. And I think one thing Peter captures in his book, and I really would urge people to read it, because there's a lot of nonsense about the old media and now the Internet is supposed to be threatening it. The reason Ramparts existed is because the old established media wasn't doing its job. The New York Times basically supported the war. And when Martin Luther King came out against the war, they condemned him for his speech at Riverside, that historic, famous speech. We published the speech. And as Peter points out in his book, Martin Luther King actually came out publicly against the war because of a series that he read in Ramparts, where we exposed what the bombing was doing to the children of Vietnam, the murder. You know, after all, 3.5 million people died in that war, which we think now of no one defends, but, you know, oh, it was just a mistake and so forth. And so, you know, Ramparts had great variety. It was one of the things wrong with the left now is it's too rigid and politically correct. Ramparts was open. It was wild. Yes, there was room for me. But, you know, the great thing about Ramparts is it wasn't narrow ideologically at all. And so I would make two points, and I think the book is important. I beg people to read it for that reason. One is it really examines the role of the mass media in condoning these wars like Vietnam and cheering it on. And it criticizes the mass media, as Ramparts did, for ignoring the civil rights movement at first and not supporting it vigorously, and certainly not supporting the connection of the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. And, you know, again, let me just say, the book is really exciting to read, but the times were exciting. And, you know, you mentioned that I'm now the editor of Truth Dig, and I sometimes tell people Truth Dig is Ramparts on speed. You know, because of the Internet, we can get things out, we can publish. We published Kevin Tillman's article on Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, about the death of his brother, and Kevin was there in Afghanistan when his brother was killed. And that got millions of readers, something far beyond what Ramparts can do. But I think what we have to do, particularly on the left, is to get back that energy, that excitement, and that search for truth that Ramparts represented.
Well, you know, one of the things I thought was remarkable about the book and about Ramparts, and the book, again, is called A Bomb in Every Issue, and Peter Richardson, let's bring you back in on this, is that Ramparts forced the mainstream media to address these issues that they had been neglecting. So talk a bit about that first, and then let's talk about today. Is anybody actually forcing the mainstream media to do that? But talk about the historic aspect first.
What Ramparts was able to do was, as you say, force the mainstream media to cover its stories. Many of the big stories were whistleblower stories. And what Ramparts did was not only tell those stories, but publicize them in a way that forced the mainstream media to pick them up. The New York Times was especially open to that. It was a lot easier to cover some of these stories once Ramparts had broken them. And Ramparts pitched them to the New York Times specifically and kept score that way, how many times they could get an article onto the front page of the New York Times, because they knew they would reach a lot more people that way, well beyond its own circulation. Is it happening today? Actually, one of the big fans of Ramparts, after it ceased publication, but he cites it as a source of inspiration, is Julian Assange, who said that his WikiLeaks work in some ways is consistent with what Ramparts was doing. Whistleblower stories, dropping the bombs, and you know, you see some of the reactions to WikiLeaks. It's very similar to the reaction, for example, that Time magazine had to Ramparts stories. Time magazine did everything it could to kill the messenger, to target the messenger, Ramparts in this case. They're doing the same thing with Julian Assange today. And if the government was transparent and if the media was doing its job, you wouldn't need whistleblower stories. But Ramparts showed that some very, very important life and death decisions made by the government were being made behind closed doors and for all the wrong reasons.
And so today we do have Truth Dig, but we also have Mother Jones that was an offspring of Ramparts, and we also have Rolling Stone that is an offspring of Ramparts, and we have a number of these other kinds of publications on the web. Bob Scheer, let's bring you back in since you did found Truth Dig. Today, aside from the WikiLeaks working with The Guardian of London, with New York Times, with Der Spiegel, do you see any of these taking that route? Do you see Truthdig making that kind of an impact?
Yeah, no, but you're right. WikiLeaks is incredibly important, and so was Daniel Ellsberg in revealing the Pentagon Papers, because the fact of the matter is secrecy is the weapon of liars, and, you know, with truth being the first casualty in war. And what we've learned, the information in WikiLeaks, just as the information in the Pentagon Papers and in the stories we broke about the CIA and Ramparts, the whistleblowers, was all information the public needed to have. This is the informed democracy that Jefferson had in mind as the basis. Otherwise, the whole thing is a charade. And I think Peters actually makes a very good point that the New York Times was intimidated, just as it was after the Iraq War. During the Iraq War, you know, they basically allowed their brains to be embedded in those wars. And what the WikiLeaks reveals is that, hey, it's, again, a tissue of lies. This is information that's been withheld from us, not because it would jeopardize people's lives and soldiers' lives, but because it would be embarrassing to the people who wield power. That's the critical thing. Now, my optimism comes from the fact that, at least for the time being, with net neutrality hopefully being maintained, but it is in question, we can get the word out much larger than Ramparts was able to do, much wider than they were able to do. And I like the fact that Rolling Stone, in part, came out of it. Jan Wenner was working at Ramparts. I mean, we were a wild bunch. Cy Hirsch, for instance, who became a very important New York Times correspondent, couldn't publish except in smaller he could be heard on KPFA, the original Pacifica, but when we published him in Ramparts, it gave him a much bigger megaphone. So to my mind, there's reasons for optimism now in terms of the Internet, but the sad thing is we're pursuing these wars, and because we don't have a draft, after all, one of the most powerful things we had in Ramparts, we were not anti the GIs. We published a very important cover piece by Don Duncan, a master sergeant who had been in Vietnam, and people like Ron Kovic, who came later, who were veterans and wounded and so forth, telling the truth about the war. Now we don't have a draft, and we have these wars that are treated like video games. And I think the important thing about the WikiLeaks was that it shows what a lie it is, but we somehow don't care that people are dying, Iraqis, Afghanis, and, of course, American soldiers. So, you know, the problem is that we don't have a movement out there. And the same thing has to do with poverty. Ramparts did a lot on civil rights and poverty, but right now we have, these parallel universes where the leading Democrats go work for Citigroup and come from Goldman Sachs and so forth, and they don't care about the 44 million Americans living in poverty. They don't care about the large number of Black and Hispanic people in our prisons. We have a terrible situation in this country with the economy, but most of the pundits are making out like bandits, and so it's not reported.
So the big one of the big issues is not even so much in mass media as it appears to be in culture and society. Peter Richardson, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I would just add to what Bob said. I mean, you mentioned Rolling Stone and that Jan Wenner was a staffer at the Sunday Ramparts, which was the newspaper spinoff of the magazine at one time. He left with Ralph Gleason, who was also a contributing editor to Ramparts and started Rolling Stone in 1967. But, you know, for a music magazine, it's done a number of very important political pieces. I mean, Jan Wenner said, okay, we want this to be sustainable, and we're going to use the music industry as our advertising base for this. But they continue to weigh in with big pieces. For example, this article on General McChrystal, that actually got General McChrystal fired, which was also one of these stories that was kind of embarrassing. But the main thing is that anybody in the press corps could have done that story, but they would not do it. I don't think there was anything about the author of that story that, you know, that he had any special insight or specific information that wasn't available to anyone else. But because Rolling Stone was in a position to do it without, they don't care about burning sources at the Pentagon or on Wall Street. So they can publish Matt Taibbi and they can publish Michael Hastings and they can drop those bombs and they still have their advertising base. And I'm So that's part of where we are. If we're thinking about the media and the mass media and its situation, we also have to think about how they keep themselves going financially. And that's a very delicate operation for small political magazines, left and right. It's not just the lefty magazines that have a problem with keeping that funding going. You almost have to have that broader cultural outlook, as you mentioned in your question. And in some ways, I mean, Rolling Stone is in a better position to do some of these stories than a lot of other outfits, particularly big mainstream news outlets.
And lastly, is there anybody out there today that is launching the intellectuals, the political leaders, and the new journalists of tomorrow? Bob Scheer, are you doing that?
Of course. Come on. First of all, it's not just the old. I mean, we print. Chris Hedges, every Monday, is on Truthdig. Chris Hedges was fired by the New York Times. He was the best journalist ever. Chris Hedges is the best journalist America has, period. He's a Truthdig regular. He's every Monday because the truth, as Chris Hedges expresses it, was unacceptable to the mainstream media. They want to marginalize him. Why? Because he dared speak the truth at a commencement address, and boom, the New York Times said, shut up or you're out. And he said, well, then I'm out. And we have a lot of younger writers now that are not as well known, but that are writing very important stories. You're right, Truthdig is not alone. There are a lot of good sites on the Internet. I should mention The Nation magazine and so forth. There are plenty of good sites. But the fact of the matter is that we have a hard time. I would just add something that Peter said. It's not just, you have this two-tier society. And people who are making big salaries and have secure jobs and so forth are not feeling the pain out there. They don't feel the pain of a family that thinks that kids has to go into the military to get a job and a career. They don't feel the pain of the people who are unemployed, the people who are living in Venice. I just saw a story about all the people living in mobile homes or out of their cars, just in your own community. So here we're in the middle of a very deep recession. People are losing, you know, we have 50 million people who have lost their homes or are deeply underwater on their mortgages, and we don't treat it as a national tragedy. And I think, as I say, the source of optimism for me is that we do have areas where we can express ourselves, thanks to the Internet primarily, but we don't have the ability to connect it with people's real lives in a way. And, you know, of course, that's what you're trying to do with Pacifica. That's what we're trying to do with Truthdig. And I think the strength, I would really recommend that people get Peter's book. Not that it's going to help make a living or anything, but, you know, I
helps
really,
me make a living.
Well, that's what I mean. But I think it's really important to remind people that you don't have to accept it. We invented ramparts, for God's sake. I mean, we didn't, you know, it wasn't given to us. And it's true, it's always difficult to fund these things. You know, the Pacific is nothing but a fundraising thing all the time, but it still does incredibly important work for all of its difficulties. And the fact is, people have to seize the time. They have to use the opening there. So when we heard that Chris Hedges was in trouble with the New York Times, we said, fine, we'll be a home for you. And, you know, millions of people read Chris Hedges, not just on Truthdig, which has been read by, have been visited 50 million unique times. It's mass media. But because everyone steals it, or we send it out to the whole world, and people all over the world are reading Chris Hedges, you know, not just on Truthdig, but elsewhere. So people should not be demoralized. And what I love about Peter Richardson's book on Ramparts, it shows that you can make room, you can seize the time, you can affect the public, you can energize the public, you can educate. And people should not say, oh, woe is me, the game is rigged and we can't do anything. You know, no, you can do a great deal, and it's a cop-out to stress that the game is rigged. Yes, the game is rigged. Yes, there is big money. But you can find the openings and you can organize.
Well, that's a perfect place to end. Thank you so much, both of you. The book, again, is called A Bomb in Every Issue, How the Short, Unruly Life of Ramparts Magazine Changed America. We have been speaking with Peter Richardson, the author of that, and also with Robert Scheer, who was one of the editors of Ramparts Magazine and has gone on to write numerous books, found Truthdig Magazine, and co-host Left, Right, and Center. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you, Maria.
When we come back, the increasing pressures on the healthcare system, legal, political, and professional, with doctors increasingly leaving the practice. What is the future of healthcare? Stay tuned.
Slopes back into his chair, choking back the tears, his fear realized. In the doorway, eyes swell with mother's tears as the uniforms draw near. Regret to inform you.
Hello and welcome to the Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. How Americans deal with their health care is still under tremendous debate. The medical profession is undergoing its own complications, with many doctors either leaving or wishing to leave the medical practice. Surveys since 2008 have shown this is true, particularly of primary care doctors, of which half have said they would leave medicine if they had an alternative. An earlier survey suggested that less than 50% of doctors under age 60 would choose medicine as their profession. One of the doctors' organizations, the American Medical Association, warned that we could face a shortage of primary care physicians by 2025 of up to 35,000 to 40,000. Some doctors believe that the new health care law does not address their concerns. Maggie Kozel is one of the doctors who has left the profession. She is with us now. She blames what some call the, quote, health industry complex and the control of medicine that is coming from non-medical institutions, such as insurance companies or academia. She cites a survey that suggests that only one-fifth of doctors believe that they could make clinical decisions based on what is best for patients rather than what insurance would pay for. We also have with us Ted Mazur. He's a San Diego-based doctor who is still in private practice. He specializes in head and neck surgery and serves on the executive committee of the California Medical Association. It represents about 35,000 doctors. We also have with us Will Marshall. He is president of the Progressive Policy Institute. It's a Washington, D.C.-based think tank. Will Marshall has written extensively on healthcare reform. Let me also mention that Maggie's memoir is out now, and it addresses these issues from a personal perspective. It's called The Color of Atmosphere. Let's start with this personal experience. You've found many trends disturbing, particularly this control of healthcare outside of doctors' offices. Talk about what you faced.
One of the reasons that this became so glaring to me in a sudden way was that I had spent the first 9 years after medical school as a Navy pediatrician. I did my training in the Navy and then practiced as a pediatrician in the Navy, where it's really, you know, universal single-payer health insurance. And I didn't realize at the time how remarkable that was and how much that influenced the way we practiced medicine. But then I, after almost 10 years, jumped feet first into civilian health care, and it really was a culture shock. And what I found over the ensuing 10 years then as a civilian doctor and in private practice was that there was this widening gap between what I was trained to do and what I was being paid to do, what my daily job was. And likewise, there was this disconnect between what medical science can do, is capable of, and what our healthcare system actually delivered. And then thrown into that mix is the fact that as parents, you know, quite understandably, as they were taking more and more of the burden of healthcare costs on, whether it was through their direct payment or through their employment situations or whatever, parental expectations really changed. There's been this sort of corrosion of the doctor-patient relationship, too. And doctors really rely on that a lot to sustain them, that doctor-patient relationship. So when even that becomes corroded, doctors really get less resilient about dealing with all these other pressures and influences.
Ted Mazur, what's your experience, and what are the experiences of the other doctors that you deal with at the CMA? Is it similar to Maggie Kozel's experience?
Well, in some ways, quite similar. Doctors are frustrated. We're a very hardworking group, and we have a commitment to patients. We would like to be able to practice medicine. We'd like to be able to say that we are doing the best for our patients, and there's a great deal of interference in that. The factors that lead to that are many, some of which are in the overwhelming insurance industry control of what we can do. In some cases, it's also governed by medical groups that are doctors themselves, and in many cases, it's governed by simple economics. That's not to say that doctors don't continue to practice medicine and make clinical decisions. Some do throw up their hands in the face of being told, you know, they have to justify everything they do. Others fight back, and they appeal decisions, and they fight on behalf of their patients. But the bottom line is it takes a great deal of energy to do that, and it takes a great deal out of the enjoyment and fulfillment of the practice of medicine, which is something that is not good for the doctors, and it's even worse for the population that needs those doctors in hand. The concern long-term, obviously, is will we be able to maintain doctors in practice and attract people to a profession to serve the purposes of medicine, which is to serve the patient.
Do you have a sense, Ted Mazur, of percentage of doctors who are actually happy with their professional situation? And if so, why is it that maybe that small percentage is happy?
Well, you know, we do that survey here locally in San Diego every 3 years, and we have pretty much a steady dissatisfaction with medicine, with the same small number of people saying that they just want to get out. I think nationwide, the dissatisfaction rate is someplace around 50 to 60%. Not that they're dissatisfied enough yet to leave, although some of them certainly are talking that way with more and more pressures coming, but that they just don't feel that they're able to do what they were trained to do. What's the answer? It's a very complex situation. We have to make it possible for doctors to practice what they have learned to practice, but at the same time, we do have to do that within some confines of what it is that the public wants and what it is that the public is willing to fund, be it out of their own pockets or be it out of insurance or be it out of government.
Well, Marshall, you have been studying the issue of health care for a while. You have been an advocate of the Obama health care law. How can we address the concerns of doctors and maintain some medical integrity for all of them and for the patients without eroding this in the future? Do you feel like the Obama health care started to do that?
Well, it's a great question, Maria, and I wish I had a simple answer. I don't. I hear this frustration a lot, of course, and you know, we have a very complicated healthcare economy, which is riddled with inflation, you know, cost always rising. So my frame of reference is not, I'm not a doctor, I'm not in the healthcare industry, I'm in the world of politics and policy, and what we hear is from people who are, A, frustrated by ever-rising premiums, which cut into their income, and sometimes, you know, price them out of particular markets. Then we have the public side of the ledger, that is individual costs are rising, but also the cost of public programs are really an enormous burden on state governments and the federal government. So the problem of, you know, out of control health care costs is, I think, from the point of view of the folks who make policy in Washington and in the states, what's really driving their decision making a lot more than the kinds of frustrations that we hear from medical providers, not to say that they aren't perfectly legitimate. It's just to say that what is, I think, driving the debate in the political arena is high cost and to a somewhat lesser extent, of course, the lack of access by the 15% of Americans who don't have any coverage. But I think we're on the cusp of a very important national discussion about how to drive the whole system to higher quality, which I think would create the kind of role that physicians really want in determining what happens and what they do, and reduce the kind of role of the of insurance payers, whether it's the public sector or private insurance payers. But I don't think we get to that discussion if we're still sort of back on square one fighting about Obamacare and whether we should extend insurance to 30-plus million people who don't now have it.
This is Ted Mazur. Just let me respond a little bit to what Will said. I think the question of did Obamacare help get rid of some of these concerns, I think it actually made the medical profession more divided. It adds more splits between primary and specialty medicine. It puts everybody on edge about these accountable care organizations and what they're going to mean to physician autonomy. And I really don't think it addresses in the way that most of us would have liked to have seen the issue of coverage of more people, because just as Will said, we have a problem right now with funding mechanisms, and what we've done is taken these, I think it's the numbers are someplace around 15% of the U.S. population, 30 to 40 million uninsured, and we said we're going to throw a lot of these people into new coverage by 2014, but we're putting them in the worst possible program. Over half of them end up going into the Medicaid program, where access is awful and funding is already so severely poor that we don't see any improvement for access to care by throwing these folks into that program. It's actually the worst place to look for improvement. We needed to go back first and just improve the fundamental structure of the programs to which we wanted to now assign the uninsured. So I agree, we want to improve quality. We want to improve the idea of using the most efficient means of care. I think a lot of that was lost in Obamacare. Unfortunately, an opportunity that was missed.
Let's bring Maggie Kozel back in, because Maggie Kozel, you mentioned two things. One is that you were before working in the Navy system, which was really a single-payer system for a select group of people. And also this phrase that you use in your book, the health industry complex. Looking at your own experience and looking at these two systems that you have practiced in, it's clear from your discussion earlier that you think that single-payer one is superior in terms of allowing doctors to do what they need to for their patients. How do you respond to this overall attempt to reform medicine and the direction that it should go versus which way it seems to be going?
I think that the reason that single payer was a good environment, that I found it a good environment to work with, was because it didn't just focus on reimbursing physicians for specific diagnoses. And the problem with physician dissatisfaction, at least from my standpoint, is not that, gee, doctors are upset and we want to keep them in the profession. What I find is a bigger issue around physician dissatisfaction is that really is just a reflection of some of the very serious flaws in our healthcare system. So, for instance, the obesity epidemic, a really concerning problem for children as well as adults. Our third-party system just knows how to pay for somebody at the very top of the healthcare pyramid to talk about obesity in, you know, a 10-minute visit, and we know that that has had absolutely no effect at all. I mean, the more pediatricians have talked at well-child visits about obesity, the worse the epidemic has become. I don't mean that's cause and effect. I just mean that is not a way to address obesity. But it's the only way our healthcare system really will pay for it. Children had to be morbidly obese before we could even get approval for them to see a nutritionist. Addressing things like in a public policy way, somewhat along the way, like Michelle Obama is trying to draw attention to the issue now, that really is the way to go, but our healthcare system is not set up to do that. If it can't be handled in a doctor's visit, preferably under 20 minutes or so, it's not going to get handled because only what gets paid for gets handled. So I see this issue of physician dissatisfaction not just simply being a manpower issue. This is what is making doctors unhappy is very, very closely paralleled to what just doesn't work in our healthcare system. It's not working for us. And so the idea that we're just going to reform the insurance isn't enough. It doesn't go nearly far enough. We have to decide, what do we want from a healthcare delivery system? And then we can start talking about, so then how are we going to pay for it?
You used a phrase in your book called income liabilities. You said that decisions are made often from this. You used the example of, a patient named May.
Mm-hmm.
What makes a patient an income liability?
We talked a little bit before, we heard a little bit about Medicaid and how it is oftentimes it costs a doctor. A doctor will lose money by seeing a Medicaid patient. And so the reality is that it is therefore harder for a child on Medicaid to access the healthcare system. There's just less options open to them. Since the introduction of SCHIP, that's the state children's health insurance program, that's helped close that gap a little bit. But Medicaid children, insured children, are at a real disadvantage in terms of accessing health care. And so when there's talks about more cuts in Medicaid or cuts in Medicare, politicians make that sound like, oh, that just means all those rich doctors will make a little less than they were making. What it really does is put those patients in a tougher and tougher position.
Ted Mazur?
I couldn't agree more with what Maggie just said. I don't know that I would call it income liability. I think it's just poorly aligned incentives. Many of us want to continue to be safety net providers for the Medicaid patient and for the uninsured patient. It's part of what we went into medicine for. But as the government in the Medicare program, and in many cases Medicaid program and the military programs, and then matched by the private insurance sector, screwed down on the reimbursements, whether we want to talk about this in capitated models or in fee-for-service models, the problem became that you cost shifted everything to a private sector, and the private sector no longer absorbs that cost shift, which squeezes the doctor's practice, particularly in primary care medicine, to not be able to take on the burdens of losing money when you see a patient. I have no problem of not making money when I see a patient for the Medicaid program, but I certainly can't keep reaching into my pocket to take an ever-increasing number of those patients and at the same time keep my practice viable or see enough other patients to make up those losses. It's a horribly, poorly thought-out process. In California, it's even worse because we've already seen the new budget looking for 10% cuts and copayments from patients who simply can't make the copayment. Somebody who's on Medicaid in California, Medi-Cal, is not going to walk into an emergency room with a $50 bill to pay a copay, but that's $50 less that the hospital's going to receive on an already underfunded reimbursement. The incentives are becoming worse with budget crunches, not better. We do want to take care of patients, but we have to have the right incentives. And Maggie's right. That has to do with not just what the doctor can do in the office, but the entire system has to support that. We're not doing that. We're not encouraging people to be responsible for their own health condition. We're asking the doctors to do it, and then we're setting up new programs, for instance, in the ACOs. We're setting up programs that penalize the physicians and the hospitals for not taking care of the problem that the patient themselves is responsible for, whether it's going to be obesity or control of their diabetes. There's a limit to how many things can be done in the doctor's office. We need to have that whole teamwork approach if we're going to fix this. But one last example, when we've tried for several years to put incentives in the private sector, in employer sectors, Safeway did this. The idea being if you can show us that you're going to work on your obesity, if you can show us that you're controlling your diabetes better, if you show us you're taking your blood pressure medications, we'll lower your premium or we'll kick back part of the premium that the employer was paying back to you in the form of an increased bonus in your paycheck. The public frowned on that. Government frowned on that. To me, that's the right incentive. It tells people you have a responsibility, you have to do something here to help, and we'll incentivize you to do that. We can't keep shifting all of the responsibility to the health provider, the hospital, the doctor, and not involve the public in that, and not give the doctor and the other providers the tools to treat the problem.
Will Marshall, let's bring you in.
Okay. A couple of points. First, I want to say that even though I favored the president's health care bill, I don't want to be understood to say it's perfect. It's far from it. Unfortunately, our political system these days, and maybe at all times, doesn't yield perfect remedies to problems. But on balance, I thought that creating a structure whereby individuals who are not covered could get access to group rates and get some protections against insurance companies in terms of not being cherry-picked out because they've got pre-existing medical conditions or chronic problems, and not being subject to being dropped if their medical costs rise. So there's a lot there from the point of view of the people that didn't have coverage that's important and I think was driving much of this debate, particularly from the perspective of Democrats and progressives who have been trying to create a system that doesn't leave anybody out, that doesn't exclude anybody from basic access to coverage. This is not to say that the delivery system doesn't need fundamental changes of the kind that Maggie and Ted are talking about, but it is to say that a lot of people being left out was just seen as a big problem for Democrats for decades, and it was felt that that had to be taken care of. But this health bill is a beginning. It's not the end of anything. It makes advances on the coverage front. I think it has made some advances on the cost containment front, but not enough. But the other thing it does is it does create incentives for innovation. There is this Medicare and Medicaid Innovation Center that's set up to innovate, to fund pilot programs, to try new strategies for boosting the quality of care. And I agree entirely with the problem that, cuts in Medicare and Medicaid just create further incentives for providers not to take those patients. But we need a lot of innovation to try to reveal value in these big public programs, and we have in place an institution in this bill that will enable that kind of experimentation. And one other incentive that I think that the bill does, to Maggie's point about obesity and, not creating, the doctors don't have incentives to work on the preventive side. They're not rewarded for that. They don't get paid, which is a complete perversity. And it's important to note that under this Obamacare bill, private health plans would be required to cover some degree of preventive care, including the kinds of work on obesity that she talked about. So I think that there are huge problems with the healthcare delivery system. This bill doesn't purport to solve all of those problems. What it purports to do is to get people, or to create a mechanism to get people covered over time and get everybody covered, just about everybody covered over time, and to start pushing the system, I would say, away from a third-party payer system that is so fundamentally frustrating because it creates all kinds of perverse incentives to, you know, on the provider side and on the individual side, and it creates a lot of the bureaucratic complexity and cost and transactional cost that people find so frustrating with our system.
The third payer being the insurance companies, you mean?
That's right. Yeah, right. I mean, we would not create this kind of system today if we had a blank slate, you know, but unfortunately we were, you know, last year building on a system as it's evolved really since World War II, a largely private system with third-party payers. And I think that's, in a sense, maybe the next great nut to crack or the next great national debate to have is to how we begin to evolve away from that system.
Well, Will Marshall, before we move on from this, because you are there in Washington and because you're engaged in policy and politics, I wonder if you can speak to the political environment that makes it hard to make really profound reforms. Insurance companies are, of course, part of many of the big lobby groups like the Chamber of Commerce and such. How big of a role does that kind of activity of lobbying and campaigns affect what the result is?
Well, it plays a big role in Washington. Let's not be under any illusions about that. This town is colonized by a powerful interest on all sides, by the way, although obviously business has a lot more money than other, you know, public interest groups and labor unions. But still, everybody gets their say, and everybody got their say in this health bill. But I have to say that I think there's a bigger problem, which is the intense, almost pathological level of partisan polarization here now. So we have a lot of really conservative folks now in the Republican House, particularly, who really want to go back and relitigate the basic decision to expand coverage. And Democrats are never going to go along with that, and we'll never get to the kind of discussion we really ought to be having, which is the discussion you're having today, about improving health care delivery in America. If we can't get past the injustice of the system that excludes tens of millions of people. So that's the unfortunate political reality. And, you know, I was hoping that if we could, you know, get this debate over with, the coverage debate, then we could work on the delivery system, which really is, you know, more important in many ways, except if you don't happen to have coverage. That's just an unacceptable situation for Democrats. That, you know, that's sort of the sine qua non of moving ahead with health care reforms to get everybody covered.
Ted Mazur, let's bring you back in because you said to me on the phone something that spoke to this polarization and your own experience with that. And then, of course, you're engaged with the CMA, California Medical Association, which is somewhat political. What does it look like from your vantage point?
Actually, to the CMA, we're political on both sides of the aisle, so I don't know if that's really political. We're political in terms of trying to make effective...
Yeah, I meant engaged in politics.
Engaged in politics. Well, first of all, you know, I'm a Republican, and I happen to agree with Will that the problem here is the polarization in Washington right now, where we have this repeal and replace with nothing really out there to replace. At the same time, we have a broader problem that was, I think, properly addressed in health care reform, and I'm not one to say that health care reform as passed is altogether wrong. I think it just missed some points and needs a lot of improvements and maybe should have been percolated a little bit longer before it was passed in this form. But part of that is this coverage debate. We have now placed this mechanism for coverage which is entirely dependent upon the individual mandate. I am certainly not going to speak against the individual mandate. If we want this to work, we need all parties in. But that's what the courts are going to need to decide. And in reality, although the courts may decide only on this concept of the individual mandate's constitutionality, if that is not upheld, the reality is that this whole package becomes impossible to support. Even as it stands, it may not be fundable. But without that individual mandate, it can't be funded, and it devolves into either a demand for a single-payer government system, which many of us in medicine fear would look like Medicaid, and not Medicare, which is bad enough, but Medicaid, which would be dismal and would just destroy the medical system in the United States. But unless we have some way to support this financially with all parties putting in the proper support, then we have really nothing left. The political reality now is nobody wants to discuss those facts.
Ted Major, before we move back over to Maggie Kozel and give her the last word, as a doctor here in California, I know that there have been several efforts, starting with Senator Sheila Kuehl when she was in office, to pass a single-payer program here in the state. Is that something you think would have a positive impact in California?
Single-payer has a lot of different meanings to a lot of different people. But a single-payer run at a state level with states currently in just budget chaos would, in many of our views, would look very much like the Medicaid program. Can you imagine living here in California, knowing about the Medi-Cal program here and how abysmal it is right now? I mean, specialty access is less than 30% of what it needs to be to draw down federal funds. Primary access, about 50%. And yet we're drawing those funds down. And we want to now cut those programs even more. If we had a single payer a la Sheila Kuehl's original plan, we would be looking at the entire state population seeking care with no doctors left in the state able, able to fiscally provide that care and stay in practice. If we're going to look at a single-payer system state by state, it has to be supportable. It has to be based on real economics, not just a demand that we don't want to pay for anything, but we want to access everything that we want at any point in time. And if we're going to do it on a national basis, it's going to have to be something that breaks down barriers of the ability for physicians, hospitals, all healthcare providers to have a seat at the table to say what is reasonable to support this system. The view of the rich doctor needs to be changed. It's not the rich doctor. It's the doctor's office needs to be open to see patients. And if it devolves into something that looks like Medicaid for all, that simply won't be the case.
Maggie Kozel, last word.
Well, I think if my idea of single payer was Medicaid, I wouldn't be recommending it either. But there are a lot of countries for which single payer works very well, and certainly my experience in the military shows that it can work well. So if we're trying to apply a system of paying for health care onto our system that already exists, I don't think it's ever going to work. I think our changes have to be from the bottom up.
Thank you to all three of you. This has been a very good discussion. Maggie Kozel, a doctor who left the profession and became a chemistry teacher. Her book is called The Color of Atmosphere, One Doctor's Journey in and Out of Medicine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have also been speaking with Ted Major. He's a San Diego-based doctor, still in private practice, specializing in head and neck surgery, and on the executive committee of the California Medical Association. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Will Marshall, president of the Progressive Policy Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank, and he's written extensively on health care reform. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasian, Melissa Ciprin, Ishmael Karim, and Amanda Vigil, who helped produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org and click on the audio archives. You can also keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com, or follow me on Twitter at armudian.